Hello and welcome to the Sunday Afternoon Podcast with Greg Reese. I am your host, Greg Reese. Today is Sunday, March 10th, 2024. And today I'm very excited to have Dr. Lee Merritt join me today. I've been a big fan of her work for quite some time now and recently reached out to her after seeing a video of hers about parasitic science and viruses, something I've been very interested in for years and been wanting to do a video on. And this recent video I saw with her gave me inspiration where I could see how I could actually do a 5-minute video on the subject. So welcome, Dr. Merritt. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you. I'm a big fan of yours.
You know, I saw you, I've been following your work for a while, but I saw you guest host on InfoWars, I think it was last summer, and I was doing work and I just had it on in the background. And then I heard you talk about humans being genetically modified in the ancient world. And once I heard you, I ran into the room and I was like, what is she talking about? I mean, that's one of my favorite subjects. It's something you don't hear many people talk about at all. And especially like a medical doctor. So, from that moment on, I was like, she is very cool. I mean, to have an open mind, because a lot of people are afraid to talk about stuff like that, but it's very well documented. And I really think, that's the bigger picture is that what's going on here on Earth is an ancient thing that's been going on. Like the vaccines, what's happening now is nothing new. You know, one more thing I'll say before we start asking you questions and getting into it is, I said it's nothing new. And the first time I heard about the idea of vaccines not being real was probably 20 years ago when I read William Bramley's book, The Gods of Eden, and he was talking about the plague. And he was talking about how multiple countries that were inflicted with the plague, they had the same story, same anecdotal story, which was people claimed seeing lights in the sky. They claimed seeing figures out in the distance in the forest that were described as the image of death. That's where the image of death comes from, apparently, the black hood and the scythe. And then a fog would roll into town, and then people started dying of the plague. And so the author, it's a fascinating book. People on my podcast have heard me mention it probably a dozen times. But the author then said, what if they were seeing UFOs and the figures that they saw that they described as death were some advanced creatures that had like a hazmat suit on, and the scythe was actually a hose that they were, you know, spraying the plague. And I don't know if he said it or not, but when I read that, I remember thinking he probably wrote it, but it just made perfect sense that is like the perfect lie. If you want to regularly cull the population to have some, you know, invisible death that you cannot see and you cannot prove. And then after a mass kill event, like what we're definitely experiencing now, then they can just put it in the history books that it was some disease and people will accept it.
Yeah. I think that's exactly what's going on in various ways. You know, I'm sure you've seen the Truman Show. I started out when I first heard there were no viruses. That's when I said, wait a minute, you got to be kidding me. You know, we grew up with this. We studied this. We lived with this all. But it became a bigger issue because I realized it wasn't just that they lied about this or that, or it's not just incompetence or government malfeasance. We are living in a false reality. And it seems real to us because for the same reason that, you know, Jim Carrey, that plays Truman, he was actually born into this show. So he never knew anything different. And that's us. We've lived in our world and we've never known anything different. So we didn't think to consider this whole world might be fake. And then the next thing is it's all internally consistent. It looks like it makes sense until you start picking apart the actual parts of it, the realities that have to go together to make it look like the world we live in. And that's where the whole thing with the viruses blew it open for me. Well, first, I'll just say, in 2020, I started looking at PCR tests. Now, we'd heard about, oh, they're being overcycled and they're being falsified, blah, blah, blah. We kind of figured that was going on. But it's even worse. So I figured at that point, by September 2020, I had learned how to use the BLAST program, which is like an encyclopedia of genetic sequences. So the claim that they made was, I'll put this PCR test in your nose. I'll put it in a machine. It will have 16 bases on this. It's a sequence. And this sequence is only found in this new novel virus called SARS-CoV-2. So if it pops up positive on this machine, then you've been exposed or you have it. Well, when I really started looking at it, there's something not right, because we have 3.4 billion base pairs in our genome, and that's every cell in the gene. So your nose is a huge fount of genetic material, and they're telling you they can test with 16 bases. Secondly, is we share 50% of our genetic material with bananas, and probably more if you're a politician. So there's a lot of commonality between all sorts of species. And then how about that fruit fly that flew up your nose when you were trying to podcast and, you know, and died in there somewhere? We don't know. You know, everything, your nose is a really dirty place. And what's under your fingernail, you know, what's all been in your nose? Well, they're going to test you with this 16 bases. So then I said, now that I know how to use the BLAST program, let me check and see what they're really testing us to. And there were 18 tests that were made by these three groups, the Drosten Group, the CDC, and the Louis Pasteur Institute. And these are the guys that developed, here's how we test for COVID, here's how we test for SARS-CoV-2. So I took their tests and I ran them through the Encyclopedia of Genetics to see what these base pairs or these base sequences really were. And after 12 tests, I stopped doing it because I was so disgusted. Every test came back Homo sapiens gene 8, Homo sapiens gene 5, Homo sapiens this, Homo sapiens that. In other words, they were testing us to our own genome. That's how creepy this is. Well, once I got that far, I said, wait a minute. Is there nothing true about this whole viral thing? And I'd heard Andy Kaufman and Thomas Cowan and Stefan Lanka, who he was a virologist. I mean, he's a PhD trained virologist. And he says, don't call me that anymore. Call me a biologist, which I give him credit for. And it's really true. They've never isolated a virus. I am absolutely convinced of that right now. And the problem is,
well, don't they admit that? Don't the experts admit that it's impossible to?
Well,
that's their excuse for doing the way that they do it.
Right. They do, but they expect you to just kind of, you know, slide over that.
Which is easy to do, because I don't understand a lot of this stuff. Like, I wanted to back up really quick and ask you, what does it mean when you say that they're testing us against our own genome? Could you explain that in like layman's terms? Like what?
Sure. So, well, in other words, the gene is composed of these chemicals that all are labeled. It's like CGTA. You've seen them, and you see these letters that stand for the amino acid that's part of this chemical. So the double helix, the famous double helix that Watson and Crick discovered, is a series of amino acid-based chemicals all linked together in this huge molecule. And so different species have different amounts of this. For example, we have 3.4 billion of these chemical bases in a string, think of a string of pearls, only they're all a little different. They're different colored. If I colored every pearl, there'd be four different colors and they string out. And in humans, we have 3.4 billion of those. Now, an onion has 11 billion. Why does an onion, we think we're so smart, why does an onion have more than we do? Yeah. And the reason is because an onion is completely self-contained. It's like a standalone organism. But humans are kind of like a multilateral corporation that we've outsourced some things. So we actually have, in our human body, we have more genetic material from bacteria than we do human genetic material. That's kind of creepy. It's kind of like we are a walking bacterial colony with a little bit of human there in the middle somewhere. And so we don't do, like, our bacteria in our gut are very primary agents for our immune system to work. It's like a corporate outsourcing certain activities. We have bacteria on our skin that help preserve our skin integrity. They want to kill that with all this hateful alcohol stuff on the walls, by the way. They wanted you to wash your hands 20 times a day and put that alcohol stuff on. Not good for you. I hate going over to Planet Fitness and they have to this terrible toxic chemical. You have to, I love Planet Fitness, but you got to wipe your things down. They want you to wipe it down with that toxic thing. This is all bad for us because we need our bacteria. We are working in commensal bliss with them. But you see, when they say that they test our genome, or when they do a test, a bacteria or a virus, theoretically, if viruses exist, they claim that they have RNA or DNA as genetic material. And so what they did was early on, it was December of 2019 in COVID, they claimed that they had isolated the genome of SARS-CoV-2. And it's interesting because, again, you look at the details. Really? I mean, I looked at that paper and I read it. It's not an isolate of anything. They just dipsticked, they put out some lung goo and they ran it through all this computerized stuff and came out with a genome. And it's called a consensus genome. You have to vote on it, essentially. It's just algorithms.
Yeah.
This is done the same way they do global warming. It's all by computer algorithm. And in fact, here's an easy test that anybody can do if they don't get the difference. We can isolate bacteria. When I was a little kid, my dad was a real scientist, and he taught me how to isolate bacteria. You know, in my bedroom, I had a little desk, and we had petri dishes, and it takes about $20 of stuff in a microscope, and you can see bacteria colonies. You know, I swab my nose, I put it on the petri dish, and you can see there's a yellow colony and a white colony, and there are different kinds of bacteria in your nose, and they all grow. And then you take one of those, and you retransplant it, and you get a pure yellow color on the next transplant, you say, well, I guess I've got a pure colony. I'll look at it. And then you can actually look at it under the microscope and you could see the bacteria. This is why we know you can isolate bacteria. But if you go to the Google search and you Google how to isolate bacteria, you'll get that process I just told you. Try then going to the Google search and say how to isolate a virus. It's pretty funny.
Yeah,
it's
like, I have heard that. And it involves like mixing it together with a bunch of other things, which is like the exact opposite of isolation.
Right. I mean, and pretty soon it's like, you know, like the smoke and mirrors, pretty soon they go a couple steps into it, and then it's immediately onto the computer. Again, it's all computer algorithm.
Yeah.
Because they have nothing else to come up with. So they came up with a theoretical genome, this genetic sequence of ACGT repeating, you know, 1,200 times for the genome of SARS-CoV-2. And then they claim that this is so unique that that sequence doesn't occur in anything else in nature. Now, this is my point about the fact that we share 50% of our sequence with bananas. You know, people think that we're, you know, closest to apes in our genetic background. Well, it turns out we're closest to pigs.
Yeah, you know, I've heard that.
It's like what we've been told is just not right. It's all manipulated. But the thing of it is, they claim that they're using these little snippets of your genes to tell you whether or not the little snippet of this SARS-CoV-2 gene to tell if you've been exposed. And first of all, if you've got 3.4 million bases in your genetic makeup, and they're testing you with 12 or 16 bases from this virus, it's kind of like, I'm going to test for pollution in the ocean by taking out a teaspoon. Okay, it doesn't make sense. And that's when I started saying, wait a minute, let's just take a step back and look at common sense here. Can you even do what they're saying? And the answer is no. They just can't do it like that. And then when you discover that they weren't even testing to what they to, and if they were testing to SARS-CoV-2, then that sequence is also in ours. Now, when I was in medical school back in the 70s, they told us that we had viral genomes, we had viral genetics within our genetics, that they had over the eons of human evolution somehow gotten in there and become part of our genetic material. Well, if that's true, then again, how can they possibly sort out
right. What's
us and what's exactly. This virus? And I will tell you I used to work in electron microscopy lab. Now, remember that blue ball that they would show you? And it was in COVID, they'd show this spiky blue ball and that they would always label it as the SARS-CoV-2.
Yeah.
Well, that was not anything. That was computer generated image. You know,
yeah.
I Those I have spiky blue balls in my dryer. They're my rubber dryer balls. Now those are real. They can damage you. But that thing that they're showing, it's just complete fakery. It's NASA probably does this for science.
I mean, I also noticed during COVID, because I go to a website to get stock video for my videos. And every time I would, and I've done, I don't know how many videos on COVID and the vaccines and stuff, but every time I would want to get images, I noticed they had so much of that. Like the amount of videos they had of that image was more than any other thing. So I bet you that's where they're getting them from, the stock image companies. What do you think about because everything about the isolation, how they can't isolate a virus, that's the one thing everyone talks about. And I could do a video on that, but to do a 5-minute video, you need more than just that one thing, in my opinion. You need a motive because the first thing everyone's going to say is
what's the motive?
What's the motive? Why would they lie? What would they do about it? And I mean, to me, it's obvious, but not to everyone. And that's why I reached out to you, because you were talking about parasitic science. And you were talking about how before the Rockefeller, correct me if I'm wrong, but you were talking about how before the Rockefellers, you know, outlawed natural medicine and took control of the industry with, you know, petrochemicals and all this destructive non-medical stuff. You were saying something about that before they did that, parasitic science was recognized as the cause of most diseases.
Yeah, well, yeah, and that's part of it. I mean, I'll start by saying the reason that they're putting out this fake thing about viruses is simple control. I mean, it's to keep you from knowing the truth, and that's how you control people. And if you think about, I started going down this because, again, in the Truman Show, he's the only one in this whole show that doesn't know it's a show. He's the one guy that's real, and they keep him on this island because of fear. And what did they make him afraid of? Water. Because he's on an island. And so I started thinking, well, what do they make us afraid of? Well, we're afraid of these diseases that seem to come from nowhere or from each other. You know, this idea of a virus is great anti-human agenda because it makes you afraid of other humans. You can't group together and save yourselves because you're afraid of that guy. He's breathing on you these invisible, unprovable little particles that can make you sick. And so I started saying, how did they pull this off? You know, if there are no viruses, that's what they're using to make us afraid of and make us feeling like we have to get a vaccine. We have to be dependent on organized medicine because they're the only people that can save us from these stupid little blue balls, you know? Well, it turns out they crafted a very complex, but ultimately, it's based on fake science done by fake scientists, and the scientific publication is owned by the intelligence services. When you get to that point, you say, okay, I see the game here.
Which scientific publication?
Well, pretty much all of them. I'll tell you, that helps get your mind in the right game. So in World War II, after World War II, two famous scientists, Charles Galton Darwin, the grandson of the famous explorer Darwin, and an evolution guy, and he and Alexander Fleming, who discovered penicillin, they went to the British government and they said, you know, in World War II here, we got kind of hornswoggled by the Germans and the Japanese and stuff. We didn't know what was going on, and we need better scientific publishing. And the British said, no problem. They could say that without consulting anybody because at the time, they owned Butterworth's, which was the largest medical scientific publishing house in the world. And it wasn't just British government that owned it. It was MI6, the British spy agency. So then they decided, along with these two scientists, they said, well, okay, to do this better, let's join with Springer, which was a German publishing house, but now the war's over. They can join with Springer, and they made a new great big publishing house. Now, they called it Pergamon Press, and the first editor of Pergamon Press was not a scientist. It was Robert Maxwell, not, you know, a spy for the British, presumably a Mossad agent because he's buried on the Mount of Olives, and most famously, the father of Ghislaine Maxwell, pedophile consort of pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. So this guy was a spy, and he's now, and why did they name it Pergamon Press? That's interesting. Who knows? But Pergamon, you know, it's not a name you hear, but Pergamon was an ancient altar in Anatolia, in ancient Turkey. And it was where they did very, it was a sacrificial altar that was very famous. Huh. And that is the name of this publishing house. And by the way, the Germans, before World War II, went and got the friezes from that altar down in Turkey and recreated it in Berlin. It's in Berlin. Well,
that's
today.
Their admission. That's how they convince themselves that they're being open and honest.
Yeah. So publishing has been taken over so that they can create a narrative. And then the virus theory, because it sounds right. I mean, it sounds correct. But when you look at any individual step in it, it's not correct. So then I said, well, who did it? How did this come about? Well, this all of modern virology, to personalize this, all of modern virology rests on kind of the work of one dude. There were a lot of people that did supporting things. But to really push viruses forward and to ignore parasites, to really push this virus thing forward, they must have had this guy tagged for a long time. Again, they're manufacturing scientists to give us a narrative. There's a guy named John Franklin Enders, and he got the Nobel Prize in 1954 for culturing viruses. But when you really look at what he did, he didn't culture viruses. It's unbelievable what they called a virus. He started with Lansing poliomyelitis virus. Now, polio, theoretically, is the virus that causes paralysis, right? So some 18-year-old guy dies of polio, and they get his brain and spinal cord, and they morselize it into a slurry. And that becomes the basis of Lansing poliomyelitis virus, because when they take that slurry and they inject it into monkey brains, after a few passes of this toxic stuff into several monkey brains, it makes a monkey paralyzed. And they say, voila, we must be the polio virus.
Yeah.
I mean, I think a high school student.
It's insane. I remember reading that. You know, it's interesting. This is one of the things I've tried to do for a report, because I remember reading it a few years ago, and I think I read it in Wikipedia, and they cleansed it from Wikipedia because I can't find it anymore. But they listed all these so-called proofs of a virus, including what you're talking about. And it was very graphic. They're talking about how they opened up the head of a monkey and they kept throwing this toxin in, and they just kept adding more and more toxin until they killed the monkey. And they're like, see, it's proof of a virus. And then there were several different experiments they did like that. And the most interesting part of it was at the end of it, they said, obviously all these proofs weren't really proofs. They were frauds. But coincidentally, right, we know today that the virus is real, so it doesn't matter if they were frauds. You know, it was like some ridiculous thing like that.
That's essentially what happened.
Yeah.
You know, even at the end of those studies, I have those studies that come up. Some of them, interestingly, part of the way they control science is they control your access to the medical literature and the scientific literature now through paywalls. So things I could find 5 years ago are not available now. But you can find them in indirect ways sometimes. And the paper that you're referring to, that one about they first did the poliomyelitis virus by taking it out of this dead kid and putting it in monkeys, and then they did it into rats. The guy that really got famous for this, they did it into rats, and they said, but no positive results have been secured in animals other than cotton rats. So it was only this one kind of rat they could even make this work. And then they said, it's conceivable, however, that the results secured may be due to some peculiarities of this particular strain of virus. And most tellingly, they say, attempts to transmit the infection by the intranasal route have been so far without success. So they admit, not only could they not make it happen, no matter how much of this toxic gunk they put into other animals, they couldn't get them to be paralyzed. But not only that, they could never transmit it nasally. Now, what are we being told? That viruses transmit through the air, that they are coming in our breathing. That has never been shown. And that's where I got into the parasites in a way, because when I went back, I have five generations of medical books in my house. I thought, how far back am I going to have to go to find when we don't talk about viruses? And it turned out it was just mine. I looked up transmission of disease, and It didn't talk about viruses. It talked about parasites. That's from 1980.
1980? Wow.
1980. I'm telling you. So, you know, even though they believed in viruses when I graduated medical school in 1980, they didn't use them as the prototype to explain how disease was transmitted because they couldn't prove it. You see?
Yeah.
You can't prove aerosol transmission of disease that way. And what is so people say, well, if there's no poliomyelitis virus, what's polio? Well, it turns out, and this all fits, once you see the world right, all the little factoids can fit into place like a puzzle, right? It turns out it's insecticide that was sprayed in the cities in the summer as an insect control mechanism. Insecticides are neurotoxins. And so this damages the part of the brain and spinal cord. It's a neurotoxin. And when it, here's another point. Why do we, they claim, flu is also not a virus. I can prove.
But I think flu is just a body claim. Do you think it's exosomes? I did a video on that. I thought that was very interesting research, that the exosome is just a natural process of.
It's electromagnetic. It's an electromagnetic disease, and we can talk about that. Okay. But when you look at flu, what do they tell us? They tell us we get the flu in the winter because we're all inside breathing each other's air in these closed spaces. Well, then why does polio, if you think that's an airborne virus, why does it go around in the summer in the cities? You see, they changed the rules so that they don't have to be consistent. And you know, the people, though, figured it out because my friend who grew up in New York City, in the Jewish community, it was a very big thing that they would go to the Poconos in the summer and take the kids. The wives would go to the Poconos and take the kids so they wouldn't get polio in the summer. And that's so.
So they polio is an insecticide, and I would love to get some articles and documents from you on that so I could look into that. If polio is from an insecticide, then that would mean that the polio vaccine is just a concentrated version of that insecticide that they're shooting up in people's bodies, correct? Because that's what they say. They say the polio vaccine is polio that they're giving people, right?
Well, see, I think, so then here's that, that brings up the next big question, is that how do you, this is why I couldn't believe this at first. I said, how can we fake this? I believe you can buy some big scientists to go along with the fraud, right? But how do you fake it for all these PhD students, all these people actually studying, quote, virology? But the answer is that they don't look at the whole spectrum. Well, first of all, most science now is government funded and it's a lot of busy work. They're not doing, they don't really, the people that they're there to get a PhD and teach other students, and they don't follow to see, does my work come, does it fit into this, and does it actually go and amount to anything?
Yeah, they probably don't have time to do that.
Right. False things tend not to amount to anything that's usable, right? So, but they see a little picture of the puzzle, like the four men and the elephant. They see one leg, okay? And they're trusting that those electron microscopists are doing their job, that they're actually looking at something real. Now, there's the problem, is that what we, like, you're talking about exosomes. So what we see on an electron microscope is not that blue spiky ball. It's because that wouldn't be scary enough. This is a psyop, that visual psyop. What they really see are these little kind of round things with some specks in it, and they call them viruses. On the other hand, they see other round things with specks in it, and they call them exosomes.
Yeah.
And what's the difference? The difference is they claim one is a little bit of genetic material with lipid liposomal coating around it that comes into the cell from the outside, gets into the genetic material in the nucleus, and makes us sick with a virus. And then they say the other group is a little bit of lipid or a little bit of genetic material wrapped in a lipid coating that comes out of the cell, but it's harmless. Now, when you see an electron microscope, it's not a movie. It's just a still life, a black and white still life photograph. So it's like taking a picture of a guy standing in front of a bank with a gym bag. And then you make up a big story and you say, he's obviously going in to rob the bank. Well, but you don't know that. He could be just, he could have just made taken a bunch of money out of the bank in that bag. And he could just be going to the gym.
You don't know if this lipid covered thing was going in or out of the cell.
Right. It's just a still life. And so they created, again, a story around it, and virology students believe it. So then you can harvest out these exosomes, and you can then think. So to give them the benefit of the best doubt is, I will assume that in the 1950s, when they were coming up with a polio vaccine, these guys were thinking of it that way. And they harvested something from human beings from sick human beings, I guess, that they thought was the virus, and then they toxified it by doing some stuff and put it into a vaccine. I mean, I woke up to vaccines in 2014 when the flu vaccine was being mandated for nurses. And being a libertarian bent person, they came up to me and they said, "What do you think about us being forced to have this vaccine?" I said, "Well, obviously it's unethical medically. But let me just look into it. I haven't really looked." And I started researching the flu vaccine, and I discovered very easy things. I'm wondering whether the university guys were not looking at this. Here's some very interesting statistics. At that time in 2014, I think, 76% of Americans took the flu vaccine regularly, but only 5% of Estonians. And yet, by the World Health Organization, we had the same death rate of flu. What's that tell you about the flu vaccine? And nobody seems to be... It's not hard to figure this stuff out. So whatever they're doing, either it has no effect or they're putting toxins in. The other thing about vaccines I discovered, when you go back in time and you look at the deaths, you remember, you see all these people dying on the field with the COVID vaccine, these soccer players. And by my friend's count, that's a big soccer fan, he says, we've lost 10 to 11 professional soccer teams to this thing. In any case, I went back to the FIFA data on death on the field. They don't keep all deaths, but they keep how many soccer players die every year on the field. And it goes back to 1885. And it turns out from 1885 to 1995, there were only 0 to 3 deaths every year on the field. And surprisingly, they weren't from heart, very rare where they had anything to do with the heart. They were mostly running into each other, the goalpost, or being struck by lightning, right? It's amazing how many soccer players die that way. But then starting in 2000, not 2021 with the COVID vaccine, but starting in 2000, we went from 0 to 3 to 3 to 10.
Now, I heard someone theorize recently that they were putting stuff in the flu vaccines years ago to prepare for this event. Have you heard anything about that? I mean, that seems to make sense to me because a lot of people are showing that the death numbers show that there is some type of disease or virus out there. I'm very skeptical of that. And I heard someone counter it by saying, no, they've been spiking for lack of a better word, maybe that's not the best word, but, you know, they've been putting junk in the flu vaccines years ago. What's your take on that?
There's two interpretations. I mean, first of all, we can't prove that because we can't, every year. So the one interpretation is they're purposely slowly poisoning us to convince us of all this. And in favor of that argument is virus in Latin means poison. It does not mean a little germ that floats around in the air. So they could have been doing
another admission.
But the other, and I think more probable solution is that they set up a false reality. They let the well-meaning doctors get involved in all this, and the scientists, low-level scientists, it kept in control by the big pharma guys that do know what's going on. And just by trying to do the right thing, they made these things that were ultimately toxic. You didn't have to add very much. You know, the flu vaccine by itself, I studied neurology at the Queen Square Institute. I was very interested in that, and I was a spine surgeon, so I did a lot of neurology. And when I was in neurology in the 1970s at the Queen Square, you studied about Guillain-Barré. It's one of these ascending paralysis where you start getting paralyzed in the feet and the legs and then it goes up your body. But I never saw a case. Even at Queen Square in an 800-bed hospital of neurologic patients, I never saw a case. It was only after the flu vaccine was being taken regularly did we start seeing it. It's the number one payout in the data, in the government payout, you know, compensation for vaccines is Guillain-Barré for the flu up until now. So there's clearly something that changed in 2000 when in the soccer data, in our world, in the, you know, watching this happen. Now everybody knows somebody that has either got over
Guillain-Barré
or got it. Yeah.
Interesting.
So, but I can't tell you, and I don't think anybody can tell you that they were, which one of those two scenarios happened. It's easy to make things toxic. You know, this whole idea makes it's just a toxic slurry from the get-go. And the other thing to say is that over time, they've just been adding so many vaccines to the profile of adults and children.
And that brings me back to I want to talk about parasites because, I don't understand it that well. And I'm hoping to get my head around it more. But it seems to me from what I heard you talk about recently that that we have to take care of our bodies because of these parasites. Like, you can't get rid of them because they live all around us, and some of them aren't that bad, but we got to eventually, we got to clean regularly. And if we don't cleanse regularly, for instance, if we live in a society that keeps us ignorant of them, so we don't ever think to cleanse ourselves, and then add to that all the toxins in the food and the junk food and in the air and the water and everything around us and the stress, then it seems to me that these things are going to aggravate the situation to where the parasites get a stronger foothold in our bodies and can actually cause some damage. Am I making sense at all?
Right. Yeah, no, you're right on. And I would say, though, unlike what I just said about the whether or not they were purposely doing this with the vaccines in the past, this one, I'm absolutely determined. They purposely have hidden from us this whole issue of parasites, because in the 1900s early on, and certainly in the 1800s, doctors knew about parasites. They knew it was a problem. They routinely had, you know, solutions, iodine, for example, different things that they would try, but they knew they were battling parasites. In fact, it's interesting that although John D. Rockefeller, and I'm not an apologist for him in any way, but he's not really the guy that took over medicine. It was his right-hand man, Frederick Gates. Frederick Gates, it's always the same name, same universities.
Any relation? Frederick,
yeah, I think
probably,
so, but you can't.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Probably,
right.
I'm going to bet. Yeah. But Frederick Gates was the guy, he was kind of his factotum. And he said, you know, John D., you got all this money, and we got these medical problems out there. Here's a way to good use your money. Because John D. Rockefeller was a homeopath, naturopath. He liked homeopathic medicine. Yeah, I know. That's something we weren't told. But it turns out it was his right-hand man that said, you can really help the medicine get better by having a research institute, and then let's standardize the medical school so everybody knows that when they go to the doctor, they're going to have somebody capable, right? So that all sounded good, and that came to pass. And what was and he sold John D. He says, and we can solve the biggest problem of today. And it was hookworm. Now, this is 1905. They knew that hookworm, a parasite in the United States, was the biggest medical thing that they were facing. Now, subsequently, we used to treat, you know, my dad was a small town physician, and farm kids routinely got wormed when their animals did. You know, their animals, they'd want
the
one
thing.
Yeah,
that would make sense. Yeah.
Yeah, and they used to do it to farm kids while I was a kid. I mean, my colleagues, my little chums were getting it. I didn't know that because I lived in town.
I mean, that's another great point right there, because if you have dogs or cats, you deworm your dogs or cats all the time, but we never get dewormed, you know?
Right. And that's the point. You know, Brian Artis said that to me one time. When people go to their doctor and they want to be treated for parasites, they say, yeah, that's a third world country problem. He said, you just ask them why they take their dogs and cats to the vet.
Yeah.
It's to get them warmed, right? So we've known about this for a long time, but we just have been told. I was taught parasitology. I had a really good course in parasitology, but they told us, but this is a third world country problem. Unless you go off with the military or you're going off with other people, you're not going to have to deal with this much. False. And here's another thing that has made this possible. And, you know, I watch movies for predictive programming now. And if you ever saw that movie, or it's a TV show, actually, it's called The Silo. It's a weird movie about this, or weird story about this silo, this underground bunker where these people have been living for generations after some cataclysm, and they really don't remember why they're there. But there are two rules of the silo. And these rules are so important that if you violate them, you get chucked out into this world that you think you're going to die in. And one of them is you cannot have magnification over a certain point. Now, why would the physician say that's illegal for me to look at this under that kind of magnification? So when I was a medical student, we were taught always look at your own blood for your patient. If a good doctor always looks at his patient's blood and urine. By the time I was a resident, nobody was doing that. They always said, no, that's just voodoo to look at fresh blood smear. Just send it to the lab. Mm. It turns out, because if we'd been looking at fresh blood smears all this time, we would have caught this. The second point is that in about 1920, Royal Rife was
I'm sorry, I got to stop really quick. So what you're saying then is that things will show up in a fresh blood, but the time it takes to go to the lab, what you're looking for could be not you.
Right. It's going to be, yeah, it's destroyed. And you don't,
okay.
And also, because it's all processed, okay, there's a huge processing, and they don't look at fresh smears. They don't look at live specimens. They look at, you know, stains. They're dead specimens.
Oh,
right?
Okay, that makes sense. So, in, yeah, in so I can see yeah. that they would.
But we used to look at live specimens. These are fresh blood right out of you, right on the microscope.
Yeah.
Add to that the fact that Royal Rife in 1920 had built these hand-built microscopes, and he was interested. He wasn't a physician. He was like an engineer, but he was an optical guy. And he had been in Germany with Zeiss and these people and learning about how to build lenses, and he pioneered this whole system to look at things in fresh light microscope with 15,500 magnification. Now, he did it because he just used a completely, one of the key points is he used completely quartz optics in the microscope. But here we are in 2024 sitting here, and if I want to buy a microscope, you know, for most people, the best you can get for a doctor's office or something is something that's 2,400 power. What? Why, we really can't we can't do better than they could in 1920? No, we've been denied. This is what I'm telling about the story of the silo. We've been denied the magnification that would have shown this and a lot more.
Blinded
because,
us.
Yes, we've been blinded.
Because if we had the magnification that Rife had, would we technically be able to see these viruses if they existed, as according to the science?
Well, what he called viruses, turns out, were actually pleomorphic forms, meaning forms that change shape of bacteria. But he saw bacteria in all their glory, in all sorts of ways that we don't see it now.
Wow.
And he saw pure parasites. That's what he went out to find. Now, when it comes to parasites, the other thing that they have done, let me back up. One of the things that brought me into this parasite fight, and I'm, as an orthopedic spine surgeon, I'm the unlikely queen of parasites here, but it became because I started seeing these doctors who were looking at fresh blood smears, and they started making this observation. They said, when we're looking at blood smears, and they started for a different reason because of COVID, right? But they're looking at, and they're saying, all of our cancer patients have parasites swimming around in the bloodstream. Not some, not a few, but all of them. Then I went back and I found that there was a group of doctors in Germany between 1960 and 1980 that found this also. And they tried to scream this from the highest yardarm. They had films. I have some of this on my site. They have films.
I got it from your site. I studied it. Yeah, that's very interesting.
Yeah, and you can find that whole video. And then they had papers. They had actually published papers. But it all got buried.
Yeah.
Now, why would that be going on? Because if 100% of cancer patients have parasites, what's the chance that parasites are causing cancer?
Yeah.
Well, that's the next step. What happened in COVID? You know, we now talk about turbo cancer, all these weird cancers showing up. I started waking up when friends of mine in the military said, you know, we're seeing these young guys show up, these young military people, and after they got the vaccine, they're showing up with cancer, but it's all over the body by the time we first see it. In other words, I mean, I was in the military. I took care of active duty people, and every once in a while, you'd find a single cancer in a military guy. And it might be, testicular cancer is very common in young men, or somewhat common. So you might find that they had one, but they didn't show up riddled with cancer by the time they got to you. So do we really believe that cancer changed its stripes in 2021 or something else going on?
Yeah.
How can we put this all together? Well, here's how parasites get you. We've all been eating parasites since we were children, right? And most of them pass through. But a few of them make their way into the bloodstream where they can then lay eggs. Some of them are in the gut, but some of them are just in the bloodstream and they lay eggs. And then again, your body immune system gets rid of most of them, but some of them survive and may get encysted into the muscle or the brain. In fact, the CDC, don't know when they were going to tell us this, actually has a back page on their website saying that over 45% of Americans have toxoplasmosis and in the brain. That's a parasite, okay?
Toxoplasmosis is the parasite? Were they able to determine what the parasites were in cancer? Like, were they able to...
there are many of them that do
all
this.
Different kinds.
It's not just one parasite. Yeah, it's not just one parasite. So anyway, if you look at what's going on, it fits with the idea that parasites are cancer. So what's happening is when you're a young person, your immune system is on high burn, and you're able to get rid of most of the parasites you're exposed to, and the ones you're not, you're able to wall them off in these little cysts all over the body. But so it's like you got it's like the Roman Empire, and as long as it's kind of small, you can guard the whole thing. But what happens if you've given a vaccine now and your immune system has been dumbed down specifically, not saying they did it for that reason, but what happens if it just happens to dumb down that part that keeps the parasites in check? And now they start blossoming out, and these little cysts start growing, and we see them on an MRI as what we say as a lesion, as a you know, or a solid tumor that you see in the bowel. And it turns out, speaking to parasitologists, that they've talked about this for years, the fact that parasite egg sacs look histologically, meaning under the microscope, identical in many cases to what we call tumors, solid tumors. But yeah, they don't talk about it in public because they don't want to get defunded. But oncologists don't make this connection, but parasitologists do. So then I started looking around and found there's been a whole underground movement of people that are treating themselves successfully from fenbendazole for tumors and other parasite medicines. So think about why they would try and cover up the fact that parasites were causing cancer. This is a huge multi-billion-dollar industry. I mean, I'm not suicidal, but they wax people for trying to take this down.
Oh yeah, you know? Yeah. Well, I think it's the biggest lie that there is, and it seems to, you know, maybe go all the way back to the plague. Even Denis Rancourt, I'm trying to get his name right, Rancourt, even he was suggesting that the plague was a situation like this, where he said he knows some scientists that are going back and researching it. So, okay, right. I can understand how the vaccine, because correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that video on your website of the Germans, I think they were saying that chemotherapy creates a situation where these parasites are able to spread more. Is that correct?
What I've learned from them and other things is the idea that it may not be the chemotherapy, basically, it's going to kill the parasites. The whole idea of chemotherapy, by the way, is it's toxic to you and it's toxic to the tumor.
Yeah.
We just hope it's more toxic
exactly.
to the tumor.
Yeah.
That's the whole point here. So if it's killing the parasites and it kills most of them, okay. And then if you're lucky, it kills all of them. And then all the chemotherapy and radiation they give you is just going to make you sick. But when you come out of that, then you're not going to have recurrent cancer because they got rid of all the parasites. But if they didn't get rid of all the parasites and now they knock down your immune system
right.
with the chemotherapy and the radiation, then you got it.
Right.
Another interesting factoid is there's always been this kind of hint out there that trauma is associated with cancer. How would that be? Well, because in trauma, let's say you hit your hand or your upper arm very hard with something and you get a bruise. What does that mean? Well, you've broken blood vessels and it bled out into the periphery, into your muscle. Now they show that the people with cancer have all these fresh parasites swimming around, but early on they were just in your bloodstream. This is what the Germans said. They start in your bloodstream for the most part, and they spread to other body parts as they get out of, you know, if they can get a breakthrough in the inside of your vascular tube, you know, your artery or your vein, they can get out into your periphery. Then they can start growing into these cysts. Well, that's facilitated by trauma. So that would explain why we have what we see and call cancer as trauma. And let me just point out the fallacy in the MRI. One of the other little factoids that goes along with this, and I think it's the most damning one, is multiple sclerosis. Now, when I was a medical student, and this is 1976, they told us as freshman medical students, I thought it was such an interesting factoid, that MS is associated, your chance of having MS goes up if you had a lap dog under the age of 5, like a little tiny a dog in the house that was living with you under the age of 5. Now, why would that make sense? If you believe MS is an autoimmune disease, as most doctors do, why would that possibly have anything to do with reality?
Yeah.
But if you believe that it's something else, then let's just consider this. There's a pathologist, McDonald, who's very carefully studied the brain and spinal cords of 10 dead MS patients, and they all had parasites in those lesions. We make the diagnosis of MS by getting you an MRI in the brain and spinal cord, and you see these white plaques, very similar to like you see these tumors, and we say, oh, those are plaques in the brain and spinal cord, so you must have MS. But now it turns out he's shown that every one of them had parasites in those things. Now, why would the dog story make sense? Well, because when you're young, you're under the age of 5, your blood-brain barrier is not fully formed. So if a dog licks you in the face, your brain, you're more likely to get a parasite lodged in your brain and spinal cord than if you're 30 years old. It all makes sense when you start together.
Yeah, and that's what a lap dog does, is just sit there in your lap and lick your face.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So what do you think of hydrogels, what people are calling hydrogels? Do you think that it could be a parasite?
Well, it acts like a parasite, but it really, I think, one of the things I would say about this whole false scientific world that we're in is we have to stop assuming and accepting explanations of things. We have to look at the limitation of what we really know. What do we really know here? And when they talk about these hydrogels and all these different possibilities of spike protein, they've never proven a spike protein. They claim that they have stains for it. Well, the stains are given to you by the PCR guys. I mean, it's just the same lie.
Yeah.
So what we have to say, though, is when you look at people that went down with COVID, and probably the vaccine applies to, one of the things that we saw in COVID is there were a whole bunch of people that just kind of walked away from it. And then there were a bunch of people that went down hard, and they tended to lose their fluid, their body fluids, and their blood pressure would drop, and they got really sick really quick. And it's associated with this receptor. It's called an ACE2 receptor in the body that holds water. Okay. And it turns out that those receptors can be blocked by things. We use them for blood pressure control. The pharmaceutical company has been working with ACE2 blockers forever for blood pressure. But if you completely block it, you'd have the symptoms of COVID. You'd lose water and you'd get sick.
Okay, now we're talking. This was my next question. Keep going.
Right. And what if you blocked it with an artificial blocker? So you don't need to postulate a spike protein that has to, because if there's no virus, there's no spike protein. You don't have to postulate that. Anything that blocks a receptor is called a ligand. It's just a chemical term. So all I have to do is make a poison that's what some of the poisons, like snake venom. Snake venom is a poison, but what it acts like chemically is a ligand. It just binds into your ACE2 receptor or your nicotinic receptor. And it makes you sick because it suddenly stops the function of a receptor. It's kind of like having your car and suddenly you've got one of your cylinders in the car engine is just plugged. Okay. That's what happens, is it's not going to run right. And if you plug these receptors, like you plug insulin receptors, you get diabetes. If you plug these, you get the symptoms of COVID.
What are some other ligands besides snake venom?
Well, basically any toxin, and the body has its own ligands. Insulin is a ligand for an insulin receptor.
Okay.
So thyroid is a ligand for a thyroid receptor. So that's what we call them. It's a key and lock situation.
Yeah.
So all I have to do, if I'm the bad guys and I want to create a disease like this, all I have to do is come up with a poison that I can spread around. You know, I say this having studied bioweapons for a long time, that they really had given up. Both the Soviets and we had kind of given up on airborne bioweapons, and they were going more towards insect vectored bioweapons and contact poisons. And so all I have to do is make a contact poison that you get on your hands, and it gets into your body and it binds with a receptor that I want to take out and poison you. Now, if I want to do it in a delayed fashion, maybe I could change the shape. It has to do with shape. Maybe I can change the shape of the key going into that lock, the shape of the ligand going into the receptor, and I can then turn it on and off. And there you get hydrogel. There are patents for this. Karen Kingston taught me this. There are patents for smart hydrogel. And smart hydrogel is a lipophilic, meaning it likes lipid membranes. It would get absorbed onto your skin or in your mucous membranes and get absorbed into your body. It's a substance that it can float around in the body, and I can change it into different shapes. And they can change it. They've got two shapes. One's a diamond and one's a triangle shape. And I can't remember which is which, but one of them fits into the ACE2 pathway and the other one doesn't.
Interesting. So let me interject really quick.
Ask me how you change the shape.
How do you change the shape?
Wavelength. So the first patient that came into the hospital in Wuhan happened on October 19th, the day they
fired up 5G.
Exactly right.
Yeah, they were the first town to test it out. Right. I definitely think 5G is related. Okay, that's very interesting. So because like the work of Dr. Anna Maria Mielchia is that she's not necessarily finding the hydrogels in the vaccinated. She's finding it absolutely everywhere. And so from what you're telling me, it almost suggests that there's a possibility that what she's finding is the contaminant that was put out there that would then shut down the ACE2 receptors and cause these symptoms that they could call a virus or a disease or something, correct?
Well, and in favor of that is the fact that that stuff, you're right, it could still be in the environment. There's multiple ways we could game this, but some of this could still be in the environment, just like we have microplastics that are, you know, spreading around like crazy. So you can get some of this stuff into you, but it not make you sick because you're not around a big 5G field that turns it into the active shape. Yeah. And there's other things that could probably get rid of it too. I mean, I think that you know, maybe there's a lifetime span of it. Maybe it only lasts a certain time and the body just naturally gets rid of it. I mean, our bodies are amazing things.
Yes, and they can absolutely
get rid of stuff if we give them a chance, if you just quit poisoning yourself. But the problem is we're dealing with this Sumerian death cult that likes to poison us, and they've been doing it over millennia, so I don't think they're going to stop.
No, it's part of their problem. I think it's their job, in fact.
it is their job. So yeah. I think she's probably right. Now, one of the problems, and this is because they're not telling us what's in any of this stuff. They're not disclosing any of the truth. They knew about shedding in 2015, but they're not, you know, really giving us any information. And we know that in the vaccines, there were different things. There were placebos and there were different levels of toxins, and that they were jigging it after they put the vaccine out. You could see them doing what's called a dose response curve. They were specifically running an experiment after they'd started the rollout to see if they couldn't dial down the immediate damage. In other words, if you want everybody to take a vaccine, you don't want everybody to drop over dead on the first dose that comes out there, because everybody else
is going to go. Yeah.
So when that started happening, you could see Pfizer just dialing it down. Every subsequent batch that was released had a little less of the acute problem. It doesn't mean there's not a long-term problem, but there's a lot of ways that they could have.
Yeah, I don't think they expected like that first nurse who took it on TV to drop down. I don't think they expected that at all.
No.
At first, I wasn't sure. I was like, are they just trying to traumatize us? But yeah.
Oh, and you know, that's interesting you brought that up, because I figured out she was dead pretty easy. You know, she had relatives that said she was dead, that this was not her that you're seeing in the pictures. But that made me ask, the real question there is, how do you get a whole hospital to cover up for that? See, that's,
yeah, well,
that's a level of fraud and
we know evil. That nurses were accepting like $1,000 bonuses to murder their patients on remdesivir and stuff, and then they were making dance videos. So wherever they're hiring these people from, I'm not that surprised anymore by the idea of getting people behind this. You know, it doesn't cost much. It's crazy. It's really sad to know that that's where humanity is at, but
very sad.
Let me ask you a question here. I have a note. I just want to back up a little bit. In 1905, Rockefeller's right-hand man told him that they were going to take care of hookworm. What happened after that? Like, when did they stop looking into parasites? Do you know about when that happened?
I don't think it was right then. I think it was later, because I'm going to tell you, like I say, when I go to my father's book, they're still treating parasites in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah, you just said that. Yeah.
They certainly stopped by my time.
Okay. I can look into that. And I mean, the whole thing about the parasite thing makes so much sense to me, because from the very beginning of this COVID era, I kept trying to, you know, figure it out, and like everyone. And the one thing I believed in is that it's going to be something simple to where they can take care of themselves, where those who know what's going on can walk freely through the world and not worry about it. And from what you're telling me about the ACE2 receptors and the parasites, as long as you're taking care of yourself, eating good, clean food, having a good, healthy diet, getting some exercise, and cleansing the parasites, and of course, not taking the vaccine, then you should probably be fine.
Well, in addition, you know, I think we need EMF protection. This is a problem. This is a huge problem. The electromagnetic frequencies we're exposed to. The second, and we also need to supplement our diet because our soils are depleted, and there's certain things like vitamin D that you, if you live above the equator, you simply cannot get enough vitamin D. And I've noticed recently, just in the last few weeks, there are these things coming out. It's a war on supplements, and specifically vitamin D, and they're just lying through their teeth. Big article out of the UK. I think it was a patient in the UK. It was like, oh, man dies of overdose of vitamin D. And when I saw the headlines, my first response was, I want to see the autopsy. I want to see the labs. Well, when you read the whole article, it turns out he didn't die of vitamin D overdose. It was he had hypercalcemia. And they paid some low-level associate professor to come on and say, well, you only need 600 international units a day. And he was taking much more. And his vitamin D or calcium levels were way up. He was taking more than that. Well, it turns out this was a guy in renal failure. And he died of heart disease and renal failure and all these things. And at the time he died, he had hypercalcemia. Newsflash, that's how you die with renal failure. And I've given 10,000 international units of vitamin D my whole professional career because I was taught to do that by the leading bone guy in the world at the time, probably, an orthopedic review course. And he said, if you don't give 10,000 international units, you're probably not going to get enough. And I've studied this extensively. I've never seen complications from it. People do better with vitamin D, and they're coming after that. So we have to be aware that there's a lot of different things we need to do. And my point is, eat clean. Don't eat wheat. Wheat's one of the really bad things to eat because it's filled with toxins. So try and eat clean. You got to supplement the things that you need to supplement. Don't let them drive that out of the market. They're going to try and take that away from us. EMF protection, parasite protocol, and get right with God. Those are the things you need to do to walk through the world.
I want to wrap it up with the parasite cleanse, but before we get there, I got another question here. Because this is just kind of starting to crystallize in my head. So if I remember correctly, when all this began, they were explaining how the miraculous mRNA spike protein works. And if I remember correctly, because I remember seeing videos where it was showing the key and the lock in these ACE2 receptors that you're talking about. And if I remember correctly, that these spike proteins are supposed to somehow fit in the ACE2 receptors and, I don't know, lock or unlock. So my question is, because I remember hearing you say that, you know, the spike protein might be a fiction. It might be a lie. It might not even be real. And so is it possible that what they're describing as a spike protein is doing the same thing? I can't remember the word that the things the that. Yes.
Yeah. They're claiming it's a ligand, but you don't need to see the irony here is, We diagnose this regulation of a receptor by its effects, okay? And so it doesn't matter what you block it with, but they believe they've created this poof, this spike protein, and they're calling it that. But it could be anything that hits that receptor, and that's what I'm telling you.
Right.
We need to have clarity of thinking about what they can tell us. It's what they can't prove. They can't prove the existence of a protein sequence that's doing this. Well, maybe they can, but it's not coming from a wild virus. Okay,
that's what I'm trying to get at. Is if they have something, if they have something out there like spike, like a snake venom or hydrogels or whatever it is that blocks these ACE2 receptors, if that's what's causing sickness in some cases, then is that what? Does that make sense that the whole
if
spike protein is a lie, that's the point of the lie is a cover story for that? Yeah.
But if you're gonna stage a bank robbery, you might want to do a distraction across the street.
Right.
Right. Distract us with this nonsense about the spike protein and viruses and all that stuff. But in the meantime, you're poisoning us with these poisons. And they could all, Brian Artis is right about the snake venom in the sense that we knew they'd been using snake venom as a chemical to help them get to where they needed to give us treatment for blood pressure, for example. But what we didn't appreciate is that this goes back, you know, the snake, look at the symbol of medicine. It turns out that was one of the medical symbols in ancient times to now. So they probably knew about this. This is what the occult means. It's not men in black robes dancing around necessarily. It's just hidden. So there's a hidden science that they know.
Yeah.
And And it does relate to venoms are a basis for producing all these other things. The hydrogel is the most artificial potential version of that. But there's all sorts of ways to get there.
Is it true that nicotine protects you from these ACE2 receptor blockers?
I think so, yeah. And because somehow, and I just was reading an article about this, the nicotine receptors, which you have all over your body, so that's what they're exploiting. These nicotinic receptors and the ACE2 receptor are somehow linked. That's a little unclear even to the experts how they're linked, but they are linked. And they're actually showing that if you do certain, that's why it is true, the smokers didn't go down with COVID like other people. When I travel, I chew a little nicotine. I've never had a cigarette in my mouth, but I've gotten myself tolerant of 2 milligrams, and I chew a gum twice a day when I'm out. You know, I start a week before
yourself.
I leave. I'm going to be out on a vacation. Yeah, because I think and if you have a serious, I guess they're trying to get me to get out of my hotel room here.
Okay, wrap it up.
If you're seriously sick, you put on a patch. If you've got long COVID, you put on a patch. It's over.
One last question real quick, because there's all these videos going around social media about parasites and people are saying, oh, you got to do a bunch of ivermectin. You got to do a bunch of hydrochloroquine. You got to do this. You got to do that. I did a parasite cleanse a couple times where I just bought like a homemade tea with all natural. I can't remember a list. I did research and it turns out that they are substances that have been used to kill parasites for years and stuff like that. Is that possible? Can a person cleanse themselves regularly with a natural tea, or does a person need to take all these antiparasitics?
See, I don't completely know, and I think the problem we're dealing with is that some people might have brain parasites and some people might not. So, whatever you, in my opinion, because we're dealing with this, and I'll call it an artificial parasite, this possible hydrogel and stuff. I mean, I would say the safest thing is to somehow in your program know that you've taken something to get into your brain and cleanse that out as well. And I don't know about, you know, there's no question that these walnut husk based, old time remedies, they work, get rid of the worms. But most people, we're not dealing with gut parasites. It's not just gut parasites.
It's crossed the brain barrier.
Yes, it's gone into other parts of your body in these cysts. And personally, I mean, I'm not completely getting rid of pharmaceutical agents. I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater here. So I personally am using something that I'm comfortable and I know the mechanism of action. But as a maintenance thing, for example, I think a lot of these things are fine. But I just don't know. This is something that we're still groping through this, but I can tell you that ivermectin seems to be the bomb and fenbendazole as well.
Well, it makes sense because they definitely didn't want you taking ivermectin. So that's kind of the giveaway
they
there.
They really, really don't want us to know about that. You know, hydroxychloroquine, I don't know, this is the last point, but hydroxychloroquine is kind of funny because during COVID, I could not call. I was doing a little telephone service for people that were sick, and I could not call. It got to the point where if I called Walgreens or someplace and I asked for hydroxychloroquine, and it was like, 30 tablets or less, they'd say, "Is this for COVID?" Because they knew 30 tablets is for COVID, and they would deny it. But if I hung up the telephone and I put on my orthopedic hat and I called in Plaquenil for rheumatoid arthritis, which is a long-term treatment for rheumatoid arthritis. And that one's 200 milligrams twice a day forever. And I could call in 100 milligrams, and Plaquenil is hydroxychloroquine. So these guys just didn't, they didn't want you to treat COVID. They didn't care about the medicine, although they claimed to. They didn't want you to treat COVID. So the reason it also seems, I think this is another parasite point. Why does hydroxychloroquine work for autoimmune diseases? We've assumed this is all an immunologic disease, but why would you have an overshoot of your immune system that we call autoimmune disease? Well, what if you're not attacking your own cells? What if you're attacking hidden parasites all over your body?
Yeah.
Because what we've discovered is hydroxychloroquine or Plaquenil, it works for a while for these autoimmune diseases, and then it just kind of doesn't keep working as well. And the answer there is, if you don't cycle your program, whatever you're doing,
the parasites will adapt.
The parasites adapt, and what you can't do is they don't, it's not like they become immune to it, but it's just you're not getting the cysts to break free.
Yeah.
So what you But the way you get rid of your parasites is you treat yourself for a few days. It kills all the mother worms. And they then when they're gone, the cysts start hatching out. And then you kill those the next treatment. And you keep doing that cycle until you get rid of the cysts as well as the active swimming little guys.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Merritt, I'm going to reach out to you in an email and ask for your suggestion on the parasite cleanse. And I'd love to have you on again. I could. This hour went by really fast.
Oh, yeah, I did. That was great.
Yeah, and I'm going to make a video on this. I think that'll be my next video. And so,
very good. I look forward to it.
Yeah, so I'll be studying your work on the subject. And I really would like to have you on again. I'm sure my listeners appreciated this as well. So thank you.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you. Love your work.
Thank you very much. I'll talk to you soon. You have a great day.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye.